I understand the family pressure and the peer pressure, but at the end of the day, it's your child.
Mm.
No matter what they talk about and how they talk about it and what they feel about it, it does not matter, because what you do is your business and you're doing it for the sake of your child. So I know so many parents who stopped caring about what other relatives are thinking about it or how the other friends or peers are thinking about it, because at the end of the day, I have to take care of my own child. I have to do what I have to do in order to be in that situation. Because if in the worst case scenario, very few people of that from that group will come to your rescue and help you out.
Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dads show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics and stories that will captivate you and impact your life. If you're an existing listener, then thanks for your ongoing support of the podcast. I'm really grateful to you for diving into the conversations I'm having. This week's episode is running a bit late as COVID hit our family, so things are running a bit behind right now. But if you've just discovered the podcast, then welcome to the show. Check back through the past episodes, as I'm sure there'll be some that pique your interest. To you guys, the dads that listen, you motivate and inspire me to forge ahead with Guild of Dads and help as many dads as I can through the conversations I have. There are a couple of ways you can get involved with the Guild of Dads movement. You can reach out to me on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter and follow me on those platforms as well. You can also join our rapidly growing free Facebook group and join the Guild. Over in there, you'll find a positive, encouraging community of other dads on life's journey. I'm very pleased to say that my message is resonating. A message of personal growth and brotherhood and celebrating men and dads, along with the far-reaching impact we can have on society. I'm proud to be on this journey with you guys and leading this movement. So let's get behind this. So what do you get on this podcast? Each week we deliver content and conversations that will expand what you think is possible for yourself, enabling you to positively impact yourself, all areas of your life, and the lives of those around you. We do this by speaking to fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs, ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, and also some ordinary dads like you doing some extraordinary and impactful things. Every episode will give you either actionable resources to take away or a different perspective on a particular topic. These conversations are important and necessary because the world is changing. The role of dads and men is constantly under the spotlight, sometimes under attack, and my dream is to make Guild of Dads the go-to resource for dads like you who want to make some changes in your life and live lives of vision, action and meaning. So what's today's episode about? It's about autism and the superhumans that exist among us. If you've listened, you may have heard me mention that my daughter has autism. What I can tell you is that it's massively challenging to be a parent of an autistic child, but also amazingly rewarding. Having said that, it can be a very lonely place as parents, navigating the system in whichever country you are at the same time as a very steep parenting learning curve. This is why I was captivated recently when I sat in front of a man whose TEDx talk resonated with me so much, I had to have him on the podcast. Today, I'm joined by neurodevelopmental psychiatrist in ASD and ADHD, TEDx speaker, vlogger, and mental health expert, Dr. Khurram Siddique. Khurram has extensive experience of helping families and individuals of all ages who are affected by autism spectrum disorders, along with possessing a unique gift that allows him to truly see the world through the eyes of an individual with autism. He looks at autism as a superpower, and his recent TEDx talk, The Superhumans That Exist Among Us, is what brought him into this episode and into my world. If you are affected in any way by autism, then today's episode and his TEDx talk are for you. And now, to my conversation with Khurram Siddique. Khurram, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a great pleasure. It really is. And it's interesting how this podcast today has come about. I first met you only a few days back, funny enough, at a TEDx talk in Sevenoaks that a friend of mine was appearing at. And I sat down on the kind of second row of this theatre, and the first words that came out of your mouth and the subject that you were talking about was the superhumans that exist among us. The first words that came out of your mouth was, I think, along the lines of, picture this, a six-year-old girl. And as soon as you started talking, I was captivated. And the reason that I was captivated was because, and some people that listen to the podcast on a regular basis will know this, my daughter, who's 12 now, was diagnosed with autism when she was around the age of six. And so as you begin to get further into your story about the superhumans that exist among us and the experience of autistic children, specifically autistic people, it began to kind of ring bells in my head and resonate with me in a way that I'd never heard anyone speak about people on the spectrum before. And so that's how this podcast episode has come about. So I'm eternally grateful to you for kind of coming into my world, I think is the expression.
It is my pleasure. And I you won't believe it, like when I was talking to the audience, like, you were one of the person that I was focusing on, because you were at the very front row, like the second or third row. So I was focusing on you, and I thought you, and I think you were the first one of the few people who got up after and who clapped when I ended the talk. So I can remember it, and I can see that when you got up, I actually saw the expressions on your face, and I was like, wow. Like, it hit me really hard when I saw you and you started clapping, and I saw the expressions on your face, like, okay. I thought that I did link up with the crowd, with the audience, and my story, like, were kind of reminded people of their experiences. And that's what I wanted people to know, that this is how it feels. Because talking to a global audience, I think these kind of stories are required, because that resonates with them. And that actually grounds them to reality, that we were talking a lot about the theory of it, but it's actually the person and the people around them that suffer the most.
Mm-hmm. And I think the thing is, when what you probably saw on my face was relief, because it's the first time I'd ever heard anyone talk about it like that. And it was almost like you were inside the head of an autistic person. And that was kind of, that was why I think it resonated so much, because I think that it's very difficult for somebody that is not on the spectrum to fully understand what is going through. We can watch videos, we can read textbooks, we can speak, but it's often difficult, because not all autistic children, I think, and adults articulate how they're feeling. They don't always know how they're feeling themselves. So trying to actually kind of get them to verbalize it is a difficult thing. So as a parent, often, particularly in the early days when my daughter was younger, there would be no verbalization of it. So it was impossible to, and for a parent, that's very hard, because usually, like my youngest daughter, she can say, "Daddy, I feel sad because of this," or "Daddy, I feel frustrated because of this," or "Daddy, I had a bad day at school because of this." But my oldest daughter, when she was in those early days, she didn't say anything. So it was hard watching her go through that torture and torment herself. But also, it's hard for parents, because you're like, I want to take your pain away, and particularly as a father, because as dads, we want to fix. We have a natural tendency to want to fix, and not being able to do that is kind of quite heartbreaking. Going to bed at night thinking, like, this is something I can't fix. This is something I can't put right. You know what I mean?
No. I think you're absolutely right. And again, what you're saying is what I've heard from most of the parents, because they say we want to help, but we don't know what to help. Because if we don't know where we can help, then how can we improve a situation? As you said, fix a situation. And it's funny that you said that you felt that I was in your head. These are the kind of comments that I get from my patients, especially the adult patients. And when they say that, you actually are telling me what I'm thinking inside. How do you do that? I said, I don't know how I do it, but I do connect with people. And today I was talking to somebody, a friend of a friend, who called me with regards to the son. And She started talking to me about autism and ADHD, and because I work in Basingstoke and I live in London, so it's an hour and a half drive. I said, I have all the time in the world if you want to speak to me about it. And then she said, the kind of spin you give about autism, I've not heard anybody speaking about autism like this. You see it as if it is a very positive thing. I said, yeah, there are lots of positives if you want to see it. But at the same time, there are very difficult stages that these individuals go through. That they experience, especially, and the families, and both of them together go through that experience. But if we know what to do with those experiences, then we can fix the situation at quite an early stage, and we can reap the benefits of it at a very early age. And that's what my take is on people who are autistic, but not having intellectual disability or not having any brain morphologies, because to me, it's a different perspective of seeing the world in a very honest, in a very truthful, in a very pure way that we are meant to see the world. And somehow we change over a period of time.
Mm. And it's interesting you say about the superpower, because I'll never forget when I was out once in the summer with my daughter, and she was scooting along on the pavement. And she stopped and she said, there's an ant's nest. And I was like, what do you mean an ant's nest or whatever? And she said, there's an ant's nest. And she'd spotted this ant's nest, and it was kind of tiny. I couldn't even see this thing. And she'd spotted it while she was scooting along on a bike sort of thing. I couldn't see that. How she saw that was we were riding along on a bike, on her scooter, you know, and you know, made a mental snapshot of that and then stopped and then said, there it is sort of thing. I didn't even see that walking along slowly, and I still didn't even see it when I bent down to look for it. So that gives you an idea of the kind of the sensitivity at which they're operating at a lot of the time.
Exactly. And again, if you remember, I talked about the sensory modalities where they're able to hear things that other people cannot hear. For example, they can hear the buzzing of the television even when it is switched off, or the buzzing of the electricity going through the walls when it's not there. And believe me, so in so many cases, these people 10 years ago were diagnosed with having psychotic disorder, because they said they could hear voices and they could hear noises, where actually they were actually hearing voices or noises because they had an amplified way of hearing, and they could kind of decipher very ultrasonic kind of frequencies that no other human can. So yes, they were, but that was reality. And again, I've seen so many cases. Again, when you said she saw the ant's nest, and was that they can read things or can see things that others cannot, because they have the attention of detail, and their sensory powers are so augmented at times. And again, it can be a curse. For example, the example that they gave of the six-year-old standing outside because of the sensory overload, the noise, the voices, the proximity, the touch, the tactile feelings, it can become such a curse for that person if you don't understand where is it coming from. So the same thing can be good and bad for the same person depending on the situation.
Yeah. My one thing that I want to kind of delve into with you this evening, Kerem, is what kind of people go through in those kind of early days. And one of the things, and I'm going to be perfectly candid about this, before my daughter was diagnosed, I kind of thought to myself, well, what's all this thing with autism? Surely there can't be all these kids being diagnosed with autism and stuff. And I was kind of, well, not dismissive about it, but like a lot of parents, I was just like, I just didn't really think it was a thing even. And in possibly my ignorance, but I just didn't even, it just didn't register with me. And so we went on a holiday to Menorca, and she'd always been a little bit quirky, but nothing more than that. And we came back from holiday, and this is how quick it happened. Literally, as soon as we got back from holiday, the behavior just switched in me, like almost overnight. And it took us by surprise. It shocked us, because we were like, well, what's happened here? And we initially we thought, you know, it was just a stage she was going through and she was being naughty. And we the traditional things that we'd been used before, like timeout, just stopped working almost immediately. And we were kind of, it was the biggest curveball we'd ever been thrown, and we couldn't work out what was happening. She was going to school and she was getting into problems at school, and it happened so fast. It was so out of character, and we just, and what happened in the end was the school was, I think they ended up keeping her out of classes, and I don't know what she wasn't excluded, but she was kind of, she was isolated from her friends. So she began to get isolated. And at the same time, some friends of ours said, oh, well, there's this lady I know who does private assessments on children for special needs and stuff. She came to the house. Initially, we were looking at maybe PDA. And then she said, I think you need to go to the doctor and see whether you can get the ball started for autism diagnosis, because I think this is what she has. But that didn't really help that much, because we didn't know what it was. We didn't know how to deal with the behavior. You know, the behavior was getting worse. We were having to negotiate with the school. The school weren't particularly helpful, and they didn't really seem to know to detect what it was either, despite the fact that there was a Senko there and stuff. And we're kind of like, well, surely if you're a Senko, you should. So in the end, we had to kind of sort of scrabble around and find like a, I don't know what you'd call it, a helper from a children's center who advocated for us. And up until that point, I'm not going to rubbish schools, but up until that point, I'd always thought, yeah, schools have children's best interests at heart, sort of thing. And at first I was kind of, I still felt that way. But then as the journey went on, I was like, actually, no, my daughter almost became my client almost, if that makes any sense. And I had to kind of remove myself emotionally from the fact that I was her father and we were her parents, and actually say, right, no, this needs to happen, and this needs to happen now, sort of thing. And it's a really, that was a difficult step to move from being the parent and being emotionally attached to it, to actually advocating for your son or daughter and saying, right, okay, this needs to happen. We need this confirmed in writing. And, you know, this kind of almost a business-like way of doing stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. Things that you told me, these are the kind of things that I hear from the parents day in and day out. And they're really sob stories going, as I said earlier, there are places where children had been seen after 7 years and referred at 10. And by the time they're seen after 7 years, they're out of school. And what I tell parents is to detect early, that's the most important key, because the kind of resources that you can get when you are a child, and again, child is anybody below the age of 18, you won't be able to get anywhere. And I agree with you, like, schools have a responsibility, but at the same time, I have seen amazing schools who have done so much for the children without asking for a label. Mm-hmm. Label, like, they don't say that, go and get an assessment done without a diagnosis. We won't deploy any resources. But then there are very bad schools, like, who say that we don't have funds, and you get a diagnosis, and only then we'll be able to help you. As if they're not able to get a diagnosis, if the GP are not very helpful, and sometimes they're not, because I don't blame them. They've not been trained to do so. And believe me, I'm in the business of mental health. Business probably is the wrong word, but I am in mental health for a very long time, and I'm a trainer as well. And what I've learned is about autism is on my own, because I got fascinated by it in 2004 when somebody mentioned the word Asperger's, and my consultant said to go and read about it, because you're going to be seeing a patient. And I was like, wow. And when I read about it, I was so energized to look at the qualities and how good they are. But then he said, yeah, but you won't be able to diagnose them. I said, why? Because it was my first year of training. I said, because you need somebody to go to Sheffield and they'll have 8 hours of assessment. I said, wow, 8 hours of assessment. And it seemed like an impossible task to me at that time. So saying that, it's when a mental health practitioner or a clinician is saying that we don't have training, we can't blame schools and GPs and everybody else. Whereas, like, I'm teaching my trainee about autism and ADHD neurodevelopment, but that's not in her proper curriculum. And if you go around 100 psychiatrists, there will be one or two who will be able to know a bit about autism, but the rest, they will be very oblivious of it. So the problem is with how we're seeing it. We're not seeing it as a problem. It is becoming problematic. Not the children become problematic, but it's been a problem because it's not been seen. So again, eyes can't see what the mind does not know. If you don't see the thing, how can you manage it? Or how can you contain it? How can you improve things around it? And that's why I'm a big advocate of psychoeducation, where schools, universities, colleges, communities, enriching programs, where you go to the community and teach them about things. For example, this is more common than schizophrenia. It is at par with depression. Like we're talking about ADHD, it's sixfold common than a patient with schizophrenia, but there are no services. And it like my heart goes out to all those patients, people, children, adults in the community that who are with this condition and living with it and absolutely clueless about it. So it's a big thing that needs changing. I think that a change needs to come from top down. They have to have programs. They have to have some kind of psychoeducation around it. Some media should get involved with it. The government could get involved with it. The MPs should get involved with it, because the kind of, and I'm not saying it in a bad way, but the kind of burden it has on the community, for example, the burden when they go attend A&E, when the ambulance services are called, when they attend GPs, if you calculate the cost of that is so enormous that if you do something at the very start, it won't cost that much at the end of the day. But you are allowing that to happen. And now they have no excuses because they know that it is an issue, that nobody is doing anything about it.
Yeah, I think the thing is as well is I think that, because my wife is a teacher as well, and I think what happens as well is I think that kids go into nurseries, and I think nurseries look at it, because obviously they're being paid whatever happens, they're being paid the nursery fee. So they look at it and they think, well, actually, if we get involved and say we think that the child might be on the spectrum, then it's more paperwork for us. So what we'll do is we'll just let them go into primary school, and then the primary school can sort it out. So these kids end up starting primary school, and that's kind of when the wheels fall off the wagon, so to speak. And they're not prepared for it. And like, for instance, we had a really good guy called Steve who came from the local, who was kind of assigned as our kind of caseworker and stuff. And he came into the school and, you know, really, really simple stuff. And he was like, so when is she getting most anxious? Oh, when she's queuing up. Okay, so rather than having her queuing up at the back of the queue where there's all the hustle and bustle of kids pushing each other and stuff, get her to queue up at the front. When they're going out to get their coats from the playground, you know, let her go out a little bit earlier to get her coat and stuff so that she's not in, again, with all the hustle and bustle of loads of other kids and stuff. Sit her at the front of the class so she's, again, so little small things like that, and also you know, have a timeout area in the classroom. And so once people got involved and it was like, okay, you need to do this, and this, and this, stuff started to get better. And also we noticed, Kieran, was when we had a third person with us with meetings at the school, they held the school to account. So they made sure that the school was going to do what they said they were going to do. And if they didn't, then they were straight on the phone to them. They said, well, we agreed at the, and I'll delve into this graduated response in a moment, but we agreed at the plan, assess, do review meeting that this was going to happen and you guys aren't doing it. Why are you not doing it? And then the school, it's really helpful having that third person to go along to meetings if you can, sort of thing. So
absolutely. And you mentioned a very important thing about the nurseries, and here I'm going to talk about transitions, because transitions are one of the most important areas where you actually see the most referrals happening. And when I say that transitions, I always tell parents that if you had the opportunity to keep the child in the same environment for the rest of their life, you will never ever notice that there was anything different about them. Because it's the sameness of thing, the same environment, because autism, a lot of it is about not knowing the unknown. For example, what they worry about is what's going to happen if I go into this situation, because the imagination is limited. And if they are able to, if somebody plants a suggestion, then they will have an idea about it. So they would know, like to know the outcome A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H about the situation. And once they know that it is managed and they know about it, they will be very comfortable going into that environment. So imagine a child all of a sudden going into a nursery, and from nursery to primary, and the primary to secondary. And that's the biggest jump, the primary to secondary. It becomes from a very structured environment to almost a jungle out there, which is very unstructured. And that's where we see the females transition, we see most from primary to secondary, because that's a massive jump. Whereas for boys, we see it at a very early age, because again, as I said earlier, they mask and they mirror in order to gel in. So the females, that's amazing thing about them, and hence they remain undiagnosed for just such a long time. But transitions are very important. Changes in environment, last minute changes, even going on a holiday, that's completely, if you don't, if you're not able to tell them exactly what's going to be, they want to know where the hotel is, what are the things around it. And nowadays it's easy. You have Google Maps and the street views and the hotel views and the pictures and everything. And I always tell parents that if you're going to your relative's place, ask them to send you the photographs of the place and how many people are going to be there and the photographs of all the people, so that you can show them beforehand, so that you prepare them for that transition. Once they know what's going to happen, they'll be fine. But yeah, you have to take that into account. The change is not their forte. It's they don't deal with change very well. So transitions and the change, it's one of the most important thing that gives this away. So something is going on, which again, parents are clueless about. Teachers, the primary teacher will say they were absolutely fine when they were in primary school, and the secondary will say, yeah, but they, when they came here, all of a sudden they erupted, and the parents will have no clue at all, because nobody had told them, nobody had educated them about it. But it's, for us, I'm seeing it from angle, for me, the transitions are very visible. So, okay, this is the time when it happened. And usually it's those transitions, even moving houses, even changing cities, even parents changing jobs, or going from a 9-to-5 to a shift pattern, that can actually offset them. But again, there are ways of dealing with that situation.
Yeah. And we found, funny enough, to your point on that, we found things often went astray when the transition, the ball was dropped on the transition. So what we got, what we realized is that as parents, we had to begin to take ownership of that. So if the school kind of towards the end of term didn't have a transition plan for kind of when they were going up a year or whatever, then we would often be getting in touch with the school towards the end of the school term saying, hey, she's changing up to another year. What is your plan for this next bit, sort of thing? Oh, we haven't thought about that, but yes, we better make a plan, sort of thing. So sometimes you have to kind of use your initiative a little bit more, because sometimes the schools don't always think about it. So you have to kind of take ownership of it a little bit yourself in order to kind of be proactive in actually heading some of this stuff off at the pass. One of the things that I noticed that a lot of parents may relate to if they're going through this at the moment is the I was going to ask you what the sort of typical range of emotions that parents go through when it becomes clear that their child is kind of different. And, you know, I know a lot of parents go through this whole thing of, well, is it something I've done? Particularly mums are like, well, was it something that I did during pregnancy, or, you know, was it this, was it that? So we go through this kind of blame and kind of torment of beating ourselves up over, could we have done something different? And what sort of permission, what would you say to parents going through that kind of torment of beating yourself up, sort of thing?
And again, this is a very common theme, and it's for parents to come to know about it. It's like a bereavement. It's like it's something as if they're losing, they have done something wrong. And it goes through the stages of being in denial, and then being angry about it, and then grieving about it, and then coming to terms with it, and being depressed about it before that. So all the stages of bereavement, you've already actually seen the actual grief period. This is what grief is. This is, and grief is not just about about losing a person. It's about something changing in your life in a very drastic manner, and you're not expecting something, and it changes, and you think it is for the worst. It might not be, but it will amaze you that till 1940s and 30s, parents were blamed, especially mothers were blamed for this for autism, and they used to be called refrigerated mothers. Like cold, callous mothers give rise to children, or they have offsprings which are very cold and callous and autistic. So imagine, like they were called that, they don't, because the mothers don't have empathy, hence the children do not have empathy about it. So for a long time, they were blamed for that. Again, when somebody say it's a naughty child, somebody says it's the child is misbehaving, and again the fingers are pointed at the parents that you're not putting things in place so that they are acquiring the skills or the social skills or the etiquettes and the social etiquettes. It is reflective very much on the parents, because when I did deliver the talk about being relieved, they're really relieved. They just burst into tears, and people, because of pandemic, they say, if I could hug you, I would hug you, but because of the pandemic, we cannot. These are the kind of emotions that I get from parents, and parents, mothers coming and hugging me, so because I'm telling them about things. And again, I have always have a very positive notion, positive idea about autism and how brilliant it can be. I always see the glass half full. Once you go through those stages, the difficulty, the teething stages of understanding, it's an amazing experience for the parents. They have different abilities. They might not be like other children, but again, they have something which others do not have. And this is something which should be cherished, because once they find their niche, there's no stopping them. But then we have to help them find those areas and to help them accelerate. And as I said, coming to terms with it, in schools play a major role, social skills training and emotional skills training, and the role of the SENCO and the educational psychologist, which can be provided to school. It doesn't happen after they leave school. It doesn't happen when they're in college. Universities, there are, but it's not the kind of support that you would get. Again, the brain is very flexible, and it's very neuroplastic when it's young, when it's coming to that stage, 6 years, 7 years. Mm-hmm. Whatever you teach the child, it will be accepted in a very normalized manner, in a very stepwise manner. Whereas for an adult, it is becoming difficult. Things are set in stone. It's very difficult to change those patterns. People do change once they know what they're dealing with, but it's more like coming to terms. The social skill set and all those things, they are aware of it, but they are sometimes difficult for them to incorporate it at a later stage. For example, if they're 50 or 60, the habits are so fixed and set in stone that you cannot change it very easily.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting because you say that, because that was I said to you when we spoke at the weekend that we find that where my daughter's getting older, she's kind of growing through it a little bit. That's the easiest expression that I can use to explain it. But like in the early days, people would say, well, what's it like? And I'd kind of be like, well, if you can imagine driving a car, you know that you steer with your hands and you accelerate and brake with your feet. I said, having an autistic child is kind of like that being the case one day, and then the next day you're steering with your you're accelerating and braking with your hands, and you're steering with your feet, and the controls have completely changed the next day on the car. True. And that's what it is on a daily basis being a parent of an autistic child, because it changes so much. To try and actually work out a routine, that's kind of what's kind of mind blowing. And to your, I love the way you say about the glass being half full, because we found that in the early days as well, that because there's so much information and there's so many Facebook groups and there's so much, a lot of the, you have to, we found that we were ruminating quite a lot and we were overthinking stuff and we were digesting so much information and it was getting exhausting. And in the end, we actually unplugged from a lot of Facebook groups. We did the research that we needed to at that particular point, depending on what was presenting itself as an issue at that particular point. But we really pulled back from a lot of the support groups, not because we didn't want the support, but some of them were so kind of pessimistic and quite negative. Yeah. And also the other thing, Khurram, is that we realized that in terms of what you just said about the brain being quite malleable and stuff, we realized that there was a point at which autistic behavior stopped and normal 6, 7, 8, 9 year old behavior starts. And one of the things that we found that took quite a bit of skill was working out where the autism stops,
yes,
and where the kind of testing of boundaries and just normal yeah. behavior. But we had to get the anxiety levels down before we could then see where the line was as to where is the autism and where is someone not wanting to put their shoes on or someone not wanting to come and eat their dinner or the normal behavior of a 7, 6, 7, 8, 9 year old, you know. So and I think that's a challenge, I think, for a lot of parents, because some of the experts are kind of like, well, all behavior is autistic, and we learned that not all behavior is autistic, and for our child to be able to function in the world, we needed to be able to equip her with the skills to function okay in the world, you know, which we weren't always getting if we were saying everything's autistic. So, you know, we can't go out for the day, or we're not going to do this, or as a family, because that begins to impact the family as well, doesn't it? So
it does. Yeah. And again, you're very right. You have to kind of pick it up layer by layer and to understand what is going on, what is underlying, because some people, they have a routine, and some people, they do not like routine. Some people are okay with change. Some people are not okay with change. Some people are okay with the day-to-day changes, but they are not okay with the long-term changes. And some people are okay with the changes in their environment, for example, living room, the setting changing, or even the bedroom. But some people are not. Some children are not. So you have to identify, because again, just like, again, I'm using the word normality. Like, normality is a very relative word. But again, people with different abilities, people with non-ASD abilities, again, they are all different. And so is the way where people. It's not that autism is a kind of a disorder, neurodevelopmental disorder with all the symptoms. Everybody is going to be different in that spectrum, and that's why they have the spectrum. And some will be struggling, and some will be not with the same situations. So how people see it nowadays, especially with the professionals that I work with, that are not very much aware of, they have a very stereotypical way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is not stereotyped, then for them it's not autism, or it's not on the spectrum. Whereas it should be, if you're dealing with the non-ASD people having a different spectrum and different abilities, so is the case with people who are on the spectrum. They have different abilities, and they respond to different things at different times. So you really have to dig into that. You really have to have that understanding. And I believe that understanding, A, comes from seeing people on the condition, and secondly, again, listening to somebody that actually has autism. For example, what helped me the most was when I read the book. There's a book called Pretending to Be Normal. It's written by an Australian girl, a woman, but at that time she was going through her teenage years, and she wrote the book, an autobiography about it. And Tony Atwood actually wrote the preface of the second edition.
Okay.
Because it was so helpful to the parents. It was so helpful. It was a kind of a mind map of a person who was on autism spectrum disorder, especially a female, because we know that female do miss the net, and parents, they worry about girls, and that's why when I'm about to see a parent who's parent of a girl, I know that a lot of information will come my way, because they want to make sure that I get all the information. Whereas if it is a male, I don't get that much information, because that's very obvious. So for me, reading that book and getting into mind of somebody, because that's what I wanted. I did not want the signs or the symptoms or what's written in a textbook, because everybody's is kind of reading it in their own context, in their own mind, they have their own context and they build a different picture of the person depending on person to person. Whereas if you have the right account coming from right from the horse's mouth, it makes a hell of a difference. For me, it did. Mm. Reading that book, and then I read a few other books, and then I read the book that I mentioned in the talk as well. The reason I jumped, that was written by a 10-year-old Japanese boy who was non-communicative at the time when he actually wrote the book. And people thought that he has intellectual disability, and he surprised everybody by reading the book. And I think it was one of the journalists who came to see the boy, and then they translated that book into English, and that became the bestseller. And again, he did it by question and answer with that. Why I do this thing? And then all that explanation about that behavior. It was amazing. It kind of unlocked so many things that I have in mind. And when parents come to me, these are the resources I tell them about, because that, for me, that helped.
Yeah, and I'll link these books up that you've mentioned in the show notes, and I'll put them on the website, Guild of Dads website, because that means if you're listening to this, and you can find those books. And one thing we found, and I'll mention another book, is a book called 10 Days to a Less Defiant Child by a guy called Jeffrey Bernstein. And we stumbled across this book in desperation one night on Amazon, and we were like, listen, our parenting skills, not that there was anything wrong with what we were doing, but we were like, clearly something's not working here. So we need to kind of work out what to do sort of thing here. But so it's a book called 10 Days to a Less Defiant Child, or is it 7 days? I think it's 7 days to a Less Defiant Child. So you work through a chapter each day, but essentially it's reversing the way in which you deal with kind of consequences and stuff, and not getting into power battles and stuff. So if you're like me and my wife, who are kind of brought up with it's either my way or the highway, kind of in terms of kind of discipline and consequences, this is the kind of antithesis of it, in the sense that it's not that your child is allowed to do whatever they want, but it's boundaries, not getting into power battles. So I'll link that up in the show notes. But we found that, again, once we applied it over sort of, you know, a couple of weeks, all of a sudden it helped, because we weren't in her face quite so much as we were before. And for instance, I'll never forget, there was one occasion where, you know, putting a school uniform on was always a battle, because again, sensory and stuff and that.
Yes.
So in the end, we just walked in after reading the book. We walked in, we put it on her bed, walked out, shut the bedroom door, went into our bedroom. And then a few minutes later, she just appeared with her school uniform on. And that's just backing off, like, you know. Gents, I'm going to jump into the conversation here very quickly. You've probably heard me mention that putting out a regular podcast involves a substantial investment of both time and money to make it happen. Guild of Dads isn't sponsored, and I'm 100% self-funded. So I've recently set up a service called Ko-Fi, which means if you like and appreciate what I'm doing with the Guild of Dads podcast and Facebook group, or even if you want to follow me on social media, then you can buy me a coffee to say thanks and support my work. Just head on over to guildofdads.com and you'll see a small coffee cup at the bottom left-hand side of the screen entitled Donate. You can also follow me on there, so I'll be posting updates and some other cool stuff just to let you know what I'm up to. Any of you guys helping to support the podcast and group by donating will get a shout out on both platforms as my thanks to you for getting behind what I'm doing. If you ever wonder how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you'll be in amazing company. And now back to today's conversation. Completely back.
Yeah, absolutely. And exactly, that's the kind of advice I give parents, is that if you want an idea to work with her, just give them the idea, talk about it, and don't expect them to make the decision there and then. Tell them that this is a discussion. You can think about it, and we can talk about it at some point. Give them 3 days, 4 days, 5 days to think about. And then bring it up, and you'll see a completely different response to that situation. And when you're saying something, then you have to give the right reason for it. It's not that I want it this way. No, for them, it does not mean anything. There has to be a specific reason as to why you want it that very way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And why would, why, like we used to find as well, sometimes it was a battle getting out of the house.
Yeah.
Even if it was something that she wanted to do, like go to the beach or go to the play park or whatever. And it was a battle getting out. But once we were there, it was kind of fine, sort of thing. Yes. And again, like you say, it's planting the seed of, oh, well, we're going to the seaside because you enjoy playing on the sand. Remember, you like building sandcastles and stuff. So it's kind of planting the seed of what she enjoys doing when she's there, sort of thing, and painting the picture. So, yeah, I can totally relate to that, definitely. What do you think that some of the kind of most practical steps a parent can take if they suspect their child is on the autistic spectrum? Because often a school isn't going to tell you outright, and sometimes people, maybe sort of saying, "Do you think she's on the spectrum, or do you think she's on the spectrum?" What practical steps people can begin to, once they think that might be the thing, so to speak?
Yeah, I usually prep parents, like they're friends of friends and family members or somebody who stumble across my LinkedIn profile and they ask me a certain question. I prep them. I said, there's a science to how you're going to tell your GP what is going on with your child. Because if you go and say, oh, the child, if you give them the symptoms and you don't give them the context, they would not understand. So I tell them to log everything. For example, from the time when you feel that something is going on, just try logging it, at least for the next few weeks. What is going on? What are the patterns that you see? And you will see a pattern. For example, pattern with changes, pattern with organization, pattern with meeting people, not meeting people, interacting with people. Again, interaction is quite tricky because some parents come to me and say, oh, they can, usually the children, they can work very well with children who are younger than them or adults who are older to them. Whereas with their own peers, they always have very much difficulties. So I give them the reason because, A, it is expectation from the younger child. They're not expecting anything to happen. The expectations are very less. And from adults, they can actually talk in a very sensual manner where they can articulate things and they can give their own reasonings. Whereas with their own peers, they are unable to do that. Even if they do, they're made fun of or they can be bullied about it. So that's why they're comfortable with those age ranges. So social interaction is, again, very tricky. If you go to the GP and the GP say, oh, so how's the social interaction? And you say, oh, they interact well with adults. And they say, okay, the social interaction is fine. They don't dwell into the details. And don't blame them. Because they're not trained to see that. Even us, we are not trained to see that. It's some of us who have the passion for this condition that go on to dig a bit deeper into that.
Yeah.
So logging the information, creating a patterns, do it for a few weeks, and then going and checking with the school. And in the school reports, they're usually, although sometimes they say that everything is fine, but then there was a word or two about, yeah, they're absolutely fine, they're academically good, but when it comes to social interaction, they don't social interact. Because school, they're more worried about academics. If somebody's doing academically well, then they'll disregard a lot of things that are happening around them. So you have to pick on those patterns as well, that, okay, academically, the person is fine or the child is fine, but can you tell me about the social interaction? Have they got any friends? How are they in the playground? How are they in the break times? Like one of the typical questions that I ask an adult talking about their childhood, how did you used to spend time in your break times in school? And they were like, well, a lot of them, they say they were in the playground, but they were outside the playground. They would not play. They would go to a certain seat where they would sit with two or three other boys. But again, those boys or girls used to be very similar to them. They would not talk about anything, but they would just be sitting there doing a certain thing and they'd be comfortable in each other's companies. people have hidden in boiler rooms because they could not tolerate the noise, or prefer to go to the library or lunchtime. In lunchtime, they prefer to help the lunch ladies do certain things because they are good at doing things, which are sometimes practical. So helping them is good, but not interacting is there now. So those are the small things that you have to get hold of and get a hold on in order to go to the GP and say, this is what is happening, this is what I've noticed, these are the patterns, and then say, I want an assessment for this. GP would not decline that. But if you say, my child has started crying because they're going to school and we don't know what is going on with them, there's some separation anxiety. But if it is a disjointed explanation, the GP will never accept that. People say, they're just children. Yeah. And they'll grow out of it. And this is one of the most common thing that I've heard, that people, parents with children who are on the spectrum, they were told that they'll grow out of it. And then they kind of let go of it for a few years, but it did not change anything. So if you spot something, or if somebody says something, even on the lines of your child is a bit different, then your alarm bell should start ringing in a way that, in order to understand your own child, you should start logging information about the child and try to make sense of it. And then talk to somebody. But like, there are so many people helping on on the internet, and even on LinkedIn profiles and Facebook profiles. You can go into a group and you can ask for advice. You should not be part of that group, but just ask for advice at what to do. And they'll come out with a lot of advices, which can be very pertinent. Yeah. But for me, logging information, creating a patterns, getting extra information from school, and then going with all that information to the GP and telling them that this is what it is. I want an assessment done for this condition.
Get it done, yeah. Because that resonates for me, actually, because I remember the school having to over-egg the pudding a bit on their letter, because they said at the time, if we don't, then they're just going to throw it out and they won't even start the process, sort of thing.
Yeah. But I didn't want to say that.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's crazy that you have to do that, but that's kind of, you either have to articulate the evidence or you have to over exaggerate the evidence to get them to take it seriously. But
believe me, Joe, like sometimes for me, in order to do something right, that's fine, as long as you know that you're doing the right thing. There's nothing wrong in doing the right thing. As long as you're getting to the outcome and nobody's getting affected by this, and you're seeking some help, that's absolutely fine by me.
Yeah. And I think some parents become preoccupied with the label. And I remember a guy that was helping us out, he said, look, the label is kind of neither one thing nor another in some respects, because people get a bit confused in terms of kind of, it used to be called a statement, but it's not anymore. It's called a ELCP. And people get confused with diagnosis and ELCP. So people think that a diagnosis means you get an ELCP, but they're completely separate things.
Oh, yeah, they're two different things. Exactly.
People get very confused by that. But the easiest thing that I can say to anyone listening to this is that when your school has a child that is identified as having a special educational need, they get extra funding for that child. So even if they've not had a diagnosis, so long as they're identified as having an extra need over and above other children, they will get extra funding for that child. And then there is a number of tiers of funding called higher needs funding that you can get even before you go to any HCP. And I think that this is one of the things, Kurama, where what I've always thought that children should have a set of all ASD accounts that go with them, like a file which has got their accounts, the money against them that goes through them. Because I think that the thing that parents are kind of complicated by, but also frustrated by, is when they know there's funding available, but because it goes into the general school pot, it gets spent however. So if you can imagine the way a school operates their finances, if money goes into a pot, and it gets spent on the white picket fence that runs alongside the road, it's not going to get spent on your child. So I think schools, not all schools, but I think some schools play quite fast and loose when it comes to parents saying, well, where's the funding being spent? And they're kind of like, oh, well, what funding are you talking about, sort of thing. I laugh, but that's the way the system, that's why the system is so open to abuse at the moment.
Unfortunately, exactly. I think you're absolutely right. And these are the questions that I've been asked when I'm dealing with the kids and about the EHCP. And I said, EHCP is kind of a last thing, last resort. Before that, you have to go through different steps. If you come with a report and it says the person is, then they have a responsibility to kind of divulge some resources to help that child. They cannot just do that. The other thing that I've heard from parents, and again, it happens, is when school, as I said earlier, if they're academically well, school sometimes are least bothered. They said, fine, that they're doing well. Why should I divulge some resources to do what? Like for me, I'm reaching my targets, my goals. For example, they are in the top 5 percentile or the top 2 percentile. Why should I? For them, that's kind of a waste of resources, which is actually not, because they're not looking at the social integration and the social skills and the emotional skill states that they go through. And again, I believe in the passport, because a lot of questions have been asked, and some people, parents say it's a label. I said, yes, it's a label, and I don't believe in labels. And when people were diagnosing people with schizophrenia, right, left, and center, I used to say it's a psychotic disorder. I would not say that it's schizophrenia specifically, because the management is the same. So some labels are really not good. But this label, if it helps a child get some funding, get some resources, get them to a place, a better place, I think it's worth having it, because it's not going to help only at that point when they go from school to colleges and the colleges to universities and university to workplaces. I think it comes out and people do ask for it at that time. I say, well, what's going on with you? Is there something wrong? And if they say, yeah, this is what it is, then they have to lawfully put things in place in order to help you, rather than saying that, okay, I want to get rid of you because you're not working as according to our plan or according to what the policy is.
Yeah, and this is where the Disability Discrimination Act and that kind of stuff comes into the play and stuff. Yeah, okay. One thing I was going to touch upon, and this will be really useful for parents, because obviously we've talked about how, you know, the initial things to do once you suspect your child is on the spectrum. By that point, you probably be in discussions with the school to at least have an inkling and to start being able to put some stuff into place. Now, if there are any parents listen to this, what schools are meant to do is something called the graduated approach. So essentially what that is in a nutshell is a plan, assess, do, review. So what happens is you have a meeting and some steps are put into place, that they're allowed a few weeks to kind of bed in with your child, and then they do an assessment, and then they review what's working. And that's what's called the graduated approach that most kind of schools use. Do you think it's a good idea, Kurum, for parents to actually kind of actually from the, as soon as possible to actually start saying, okay, can we have a planning and review meeting as soon as possible?
From a very early age, the moment they feel that there's something not right, I think apart from asking for an assessment, I think they should work it out straight away, go to school, have planning meetings, and have something put in place as soon as possible, because the earlier it is, the better it is for the child.
Okay. All right. So yeah, that was one thing I wanted to cover, because I think that is, once you get that kind of snowball effect going, often that nips things in the bud isn't the right word. It gets the needs met quite quickly, I think, doesn't it?
True. So exactly.
And what do you, we've talked about some of the experiences that some parents have in terms of schools playing kind of fast and loose. And I've alluded to the fact that we encountered this a bit. In our experience, we found that often it was necessary to have a third person come along to us with meetings by either through your local social services, you can approach health visitors, you can approach. There are a number of, generally in most sort of towns and cities, there's people that you can approach. Would you say that's a good shout as well in your experience?
It is a good shout, absolutely. Having an advocate with you, it like even from children's services, somebody who's in the advocacy. You can take the person from the advocacy and take them alongside and then have a meeting, because it will have a stronger impact rather than you going on your own, because it's sometimes you against them. And again, they see it as that. But if there's a triangulation, there's a third party who's actually witnessing it, who's not part of it, and they're kind of seeing it from a different angle, different perspective, it makes a hell of a difference.
Yeah, it did to us. And one thing that we noticed as well that kind of really helps, and this probably comes from the fact that I come from a legal background, in the sense that I did legal training when I left school. And I remember the solicitor working with me saying to me, anything that you don't want to rely on, do on the telephone. Anything you do want to rely on, do it in writing. Yeah. So one of the things that we noticed was that, and again, it's difficult for parents because you don't want to seem too confrontational with the school. No. But I think one of the things that we noticed was that when you have meetings, to actually drop the Senko or the head teacher an email, even if you have to CC them both in, and saying, as agreed at our meeting today, we agreed that the following steps will be taken. Can you confirm when this will happen? And so you're summarizing in writing what's been agreed, and also saying what your expectations are in terms of them coming back to you to let you know what's happening and stuff. So
absolutely, it's very important, because you have something in written. Anything, any correspondence that you do apart from the meetings that you have, it should be done, even if a telephone call, as you said, just drop a line afterwards summarizing the whole conversation. And if they change something, then if you feel that is right, that's fine. Otherwise, you can challenge them during that email conversation that you're having. So, because it's going to help you at the end of the day. Anything in written, and it's a good advice that logging information and keeping that information in the conduit, which can be used for the benefit of your child, that's always acceptable.
One thing we talked about when we were standing in the foyer of the theatre at the weekend was the effect that it has on the family, and it's stressful for parents. And we know that the rate of divorce and separation amongst parents of autistic children is often quite high, because it places a massive strain on the family. It places a massive strain on relationships, because sometimes one parent may not be on board with what the other parent's doing, or one parent may be in denial about the situation and the other parent isn't. And so it causes all kinds of problems, and it's exhausting as well. Like, you know, we had to get to a position where we were like, actually, we've got to work as a team on this, because sometimes, some evenings, you're not going to be able to deal with it, and you're going to have to say, look, you deal with it. And then other evenings we have to kind of swap over, and we found kind of great strength in that. But do you think that there are kind of practical self-care steps that mum and dad can take when they're going through this to kind of,
I think the most important thing is the initial conversation is what you're getting at. Because again, as you said, I have seen parents who are completely North Pole and South Pole about this, and that has led to their separation, and that has led to a lot of divorces as well. At the same time, parents can work towards it. Like, again, at the end of the day, we are all rational to a certain extent. As long as we are given information that we can see, and it can be information from different sources. It can be a book, it can be a video, it can be somebody talking about it. So make use of all those resources before you're making a decision. For example, if there's a disparity between the two parties, then I think you should come at a unification, because it's not your ego at the end of the day, it's your child. Who should you be thinking of? I think that child is pivotal, because if there's a discord between the two of you, it will have further impact on the child. So all the resources, all the struggles, and all the work should be driven towards getting your child a better life and how to help the child, rather than helping. Sometimes it becomes about you, but then you have to take yourself out of the situation. Again, as you said, as people, we do have our breaking points, we have our thresholds, and we need time to ventilate. So again, joining certain groups can be helpful in ventilating. Resources like National Autistic Society, I think one of the best resources that I've come across, because you can meet and greet people. You can work for them. You can be, for example, you can change or transform your own worries and stresses and frustration into something positive by helping people, helping families who are actually going through the process and helping them understand it. And the kind of satisfaction it gives you, it is beyond measure, because you will see yourself that you are helpful to somebody and you were in that situation once. That helps. For some, for example, if you're living together, be partners, the one partner should give the other person time when they see that they're reaching a threshold, for example, allowing them to go out with friends and have a kind of a break from time to time. For example, I've seen parents, they have their own boys groups, moms, they have the girls group. Then they do party from time to time. They do meet up, because at the end of the day, if you let the problems overtake you, then your life will be completely drawn into that, and it will be a cyclone. It will be like a tornado, which is going round and round and round and getting more strength as it goes by. But you have to ventilate. You have to let those energy go out. Mm. Have some good time. Talk to your friends. Ventilate with your confidants. Have work colleagues at your own workplaces by whom you can speak to. And these things matter. Plus, investing in something in hobbies, for example, if you do gardening or if you do gaming or something like that, invest into that. Your life should not stop, and it will help your child. You should not feel guilty about it, because a lot of parents, they feel guilty about it because they are thinking about themselves. But again, I give them the analogy of the plane, for example. When there's turbulence, the masks come out. Even if your child is sitting next to you, what's the first advice you get?
Put the mask
on yourself, because unless you help yourself, you won't be able to help the other person.
Yeah. So that's the advice I give to a lot of dads as well, actually, in this day and age, actually, to fill your cup first, because using the oxygen mask analogy, because you're no good to your family if you've suffocated through lack of oxygen. So and this is, I think, just while we've been talking, I've got a little bit of an insight there. We reached a stage where we were kind of like, actually, is our whole family going to revolve around this, or are we going to integrate this into our family? And I think that in integrating it into our family and carrying on doing the stuff that families do and not stopping going doing those days out, okay, we realize that it might take a little bit of planning to get out the door and stuff and that, but we didn't ever stop what we were doing as a family. And I think that has been sort of one of the most kind of helpful things. But I think that we also have this kind of culture, I think, in the modern world now, where I call it kind of parental martyrdom, where nobody can look after my kids like I can. I'm the ultimate, and my family won't survive without me, and da, 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 da. And I think the problem is that stops even parents of non-autistic children from just taking a break, you know, going out by themselves or going out together on a date night or whatever. Yeah. And I think parents just overall need to give themselves the permission to actually take time out by themselves, both collectively and individually, I think. So, yeah.
And again, there is care support available through GPs. The care support, for example, if somebody is with CAMHS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, or even pediatrics, there are social workers who can provide the carers, so they can do the carers assessment and provide the support from time to time. So make use of all those resources, because you'll be needing them, because it's a tough battle, but it's a battle worth fighting, and you don't want to be losing your energy while fighting that battle. You have to replenish yourself from time to time, and you need to have that energy to fight it out, and you see it to the very end. For the sake of your own child, because you want to give them a better life. So if you give up in between, and if you lose energy, and if you get yourself into depression or into all those kind of situations, who's going to take care of your child? So for their sake, you have to plan it in a way, just like you do. Integration is the best way. So integrate this into your life model and find a way to make it work. And sometimes it can be you, it can be sometimes your partner, and there's nothing wrong in taking time out for yourself, because that will help your child.
Yeah. And there's one thing as well I'm going to mention in this conversation tonight is that I think that parents often feel quite embarrassed in front of friends, and often grandparents will often say, well, you need to give him a firmer hand, or you need to be a bit more strict with them, or you need to you need to stop letting them get away with stuff. And I think that I think plays on parents' minds a lot. Yeah. You know, what is my family going to think? What is my brother going to think? You know, what are the grandparents going to think and whatever and stuff? And I think that adds an extra layer of isolation to what parents go through, because they can't talk to their parents, the grandparents, about it, because they don't understand. And very few of them, few people you do speak to understand, which is why I think, like you say, finding other, you know, families that are going through it, and finding other groups of people that are going through it, and that are kind of optimistic rather than pessimistic, I think is the name of the game, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I understand the family pressure and the peer pressure, but at the end of the day, it's your child. No matter what they talk about and how they talk about it and what they feel about it, it does not matter, because what you do is your business, and you're doing it for the sake of your child. So I know so many parents who stopped caring about what other relatives are thinking about it, or how the other friends or peers are thinking about it, because at the end of the day, I have to take care of my own child. I have to do what I have to do in order to be in that situation. Because if in the worst case scenario, very few people from that group will come to your rescue and help you out when you are in dire straits. So at the end of the day, it does not matter what other people think, because you are working towards the benefit of the child, and you know that. As long as your family knows, the immediate family knows that, that's what matters at the end of the day.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. I like that. And it's a realization that we go through there's an initiation that autistic parents go through, isn't there? You go through those kind of stages, and you reach a point where, right, this is going to be how this is going to be. And it's like, you know, when you first have kids and you stress about how tidy the house is, and then it reaches a point where you're just like, I really don't care how tidy the house is anymore.
Exactly.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you this evening.
It's been brilliant.
We've gone through quite a lot of stuff, as much as I possibly can do in probably an hour or so. And it may well be that in the future that I get you back on actually to delve into some of these specific issues in some kind of more depth and stuff. What is the best way for people listening to get in touch with you, drop you a DM, find out what you're doing?
I have my social media accounts. So I'm on LinkedIn by the name of Dr. Khurram Sadiq. I am on Facebook and it's my Khurram Sadiq without a doctor. And I'm on Instagram called FOMO Sapiens 666. Yep, because that's my interest, my social media and mental health. So I generated some interesting ID for myself. And I'm on Twitter as well by the name of Mentes Serena. So Mentes Serena. So Mentes Serena, Latin word means the peaceful mind, a tranquil mind.
I love
so that. You can access it. You can if you have any questions, ask me those questions, and I'm more than happy to respond to you.
All right, super. And I'll link that all up in the show notes so people can find it on the website. Khurram, I'm going to ask you one more question, and I don't ask any other people. I don't prime any of my guests for this question, but the question is, what is it in life that you find meaningful?
I think pursuing my passion, what I believe in, and because that gives me the highest satisfaction that I can have. For example, this passion about neurodiversity, ASD and ADHD. I can talk about it for days without stopping. And this is my passion, and everybody around me knows about it. So that gives me the highest satisfaction. That's the most satisfying thing for me to do, to help somebody else. And that's what I rely on. So, and again, I see my work as entertainment. For me, that is entertainment for me.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And the thing is that, you know, it's like I said at the beginning of our conversation, you're the way in which you talk about this subject and the genuineness and the kind of the passion does come across in how you speak about it. So I do appreciate you, and I appreciate the work that you're doing, sir. So I take my hat off to you, definitely.
Thank you very much, Joe. And thank you very much for inviting me on this forum. It means a lot to me.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's a pleasure, an absolute pleasure. And I'm pretty sure that we're going to be welcoming you back in the future as well, because I'm sure that there are going to be quite a few people with more questions that arise from this conversation.
Absolutely. More than happy to come back.
Definitely. All right, excellent. Well, there you go. A big thanks to Kuran for joining me. There are a few places you can check him out. We mentioned he's on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. His TEDx talk, The Superhumans That Exist Among Us, you can check out on YouTube. This episode is very personal to me because Kuran's talk really resonated with me. In fact, I was sitting feet from him when he gave it. But even more so because here is an individual who approaches this topic with a caring and empathetic ear. Autism is a superpower, but for many diagnosed in their families, it becomes a battle for information, a battle to get very unique needs and requirements met, and a battle against a system that seems stacked against them, which is precisely why on today's episode, we delved into the practical tips, tricks, and inside info you can use to get help whilst retaining your sanity and helping those close to you in the best way possible. If you want to link up with me, you can do so, Instagram or Facebook, or even Twitter using the handle @guildofdads. Let me know what resonated with you about this episode. Perhaps you have a child with autism. Perhaps you have autism yourself. Perhaps this is something that is really resonating with you or someone close to you right now. Did I mention that you can also buy me a coffee on my website, guildofdads.com? It's really easy and helps keep the lights on here at Guild of Dads Towers. Just head on over to guildofdads.com, click on the coffee cup button and go for it. In order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves and inspire others. Share this podcast with others so that they may benefit from anything you have found useful or interesting. And gents, this is as easy as hitting the share button, putting in the names of 5 other men and saying, hey, check this out. Use the hashtag Guild of Dads on social media and tag me in. I'll shout you out. The other thing you can do is leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, which really helps other dads to find the podcast. Right now, the Guild of Dads Facebook group is growing fast, very fast, in fact. If you want to get on board, head on over there and join up today, where you can get around a lively group of other dads talking everything about being a dad, improving themselves, and improving themselves as men and dads. Hopefully, you find something insightful in every episode, so share with dads you know, and in the meantime, live a life of vision, action, and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.